Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. This is Chris. This week, Jason and I sat down with Derek Varn of the Pop the Left podcast, as well as Symptomatic Redness, which just posted its final episode. We talked about socialist internationalism versus socialism in one country. This is part one of a two-part episode. If you would like to hear both parts, sign up for $2 on our Patreon, where the second part will be posted later on this week. Enjoy.
So, I do think it's an interesting prospect, and this is not an endorsement, but, you know, we often talk about this kind of nationalist, or at least soft nationalist kind of rightist socialism and trying to figure out what it is and where it fits. And mostly the discussion is about that being like a conduit out of the left and into the right, you know? But
I'm not sure that's true right now, though, interestingly. I just think I think the left is in a right-wing mode. They're not necessarily heading into the true right.
Right. And also, it could be in some cases, and it looks like in this case we were just talking about, it could be also the reverse.
Yeah. Right.
Which is dangerous in another way, because, you know, that's the whole KPD.
Fucking Narodniks. Oh God! If we're gonna go into Yugoslav nationalism again, no.
We could.
That's the only progressive nationalism left in the world
because it's non-existent.
That's right. It's purely abstract. It's a utopia, and the function of utopia is to compel people forward.
So today,
I'm into reviving Czechoslovak nationalism. Actually,
oh yeah, I could be into that.
Well, now we got the Slovaks back together, like, you know, Czech and Slovakia together.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Czechoslovak nationalism, not Czech nationalism, not Slovak nationalism, you know, reunification.
So, yeah, so instead of deterritorializing, let's start by micro-internationalisms.
Yeah. We got to reverse Balkanize.
Fuck it. Why not?
Pan-Balkanism, and then Pan-Slavism, and then Pan-something. I don't know. Pan-Europeanism is actually whiteness, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, actually, I'm not into that at all.
Never mind.
You know, I don't even think Pan-Slavism would be even remotely progressive at this point.
No.
Not if it included Serbs, Ukrainians, or Russians. All the other Slavs are okay, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
Pan-Southern Slavism.
There you go.
There we go.
Those of us from the lower Balkans and Bulgaria, we're still kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'm into the idea of the Czechoslovak Yugoslav corridor that they wanted to do to like carve out a chunk of Austria in order to unite Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. I think that's a good idea. Let's do that.
Just like a Slavic highway right through the middle of Germantown?
Yeah, exactly.
So, in all seriousness, though, like...
Okay, sure.
I wonder how many people are going to find any of this funny at all.
Six.
We are not just into, like, Marxian nerd humor. We're into micro-generational people born before 1992.
Yeah.
But after the 70s Marxist nerd humor, like...
Super niche.
Are you vaguely middle-aged, and do you remember the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, actually do.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Yeah. I remember watching the fall of the Berlin Wall on TV as like a 9-year-old or something.
Yeah,
and then the Russian coup as well. I remember watching that as slightly older and understanding it more and being really wrapped by it.
It was Tiananmen Square, then the fall of the Berlin Wall, then...
Right.
Like in that order, and I remember all that, actually. So
yeah, we're fucking old, man.
I know. Blissfully unawares. No, I was thinking about Star Wars.
Fucking millennial. I think technically we are too, but...
Yeah, I am. I was born in, 81, so...
I'm 80.
Millennial still.
I'm literally the crossover year.
The Xennials or Xennials or however you want to say it.
Xennials. But we're old now. I've been thinking about this for a long time since I resurrected my podcast, Pop the Left, and retired SR. symptomatic redness, for those who don't know me. I've been thinking about the how since the Trump era and like this clear crisis of late. I'm putting late in like my optimistic finger quotes for your listeners.
Dub in the sound.
Yeah. Late neoliberalism. And I'm going to say that because late capitalism has been predicted, I don't know, for 100 years. But that it seems like globalism, you know, globalization has been, and thus a kind of internationalism has actually been ceded to the right wing of liberalism.
Yeah.
And so for a while, since probably the pink wave, there's been an increasing focus in Latin America on sort of like micro-national socialisms. And that's actually seemed to have, to me, it's infiltrated. It took a while. It's literally taken the Trump victory, but it's infiltrated the left. I mean, because most DSA, I mean, the structure of the DSA, yes, it's technically internationalist, but it's not. And social democracy and most Marxist-Leninisms, they speak out of both ends of their mouth on internationalism and nationalism.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to the average new socialist, there's not really a notion of how the project might extend beyond the U.S. border, even right. despite the desire to abolish the border. Like, there are practical implications that are not being drawn from those two modes of thought.
Right. And the anti-imperial turn, which makes a lot of sense, but it actually does tend to take its model of like early European and then quote unquote third world non-aligned movement, national liberation movements in the 50s and 60s as the model. But we don't live in that world.
No.
And that world seems hard to understand. And weirdly, a lot of our, like when I read, like a lot of indigenous criticism and stuff of this, which I might bring to the table today, but I'm also just going to be dealing with a lot of just outright socialist theory. That is also weirdly, like it accepts a whole lot of imperial and colonial notions, like just post facto is just true. An essay that I've been thinking about a lot is one that doesn't seem directly relevant to the stuff that we read for this, but Chinua Achebe's The African Writer in the English Language on Decolonization, where he talks about how it's almost impossible to decolonize because the very apparatus that you use to decolonize, the Nigerian nation state, transnational literature in Africa, all those are actually European concepts, every one of them.
Sure. And, I mean, the political boundaries between all the post-colonial states, their state apparatuses, their distribution mechanisms, all of the, like, doctrine of their armed forces, it's all colonial and just, like, repackaged. And you could see the way that it all played out over the 60s, 70s, and 80s is profound limitations. So I think, I mean, it's, yeah, directly relevant, even if I haven't read this essay.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the essays you guys had me read, which is the one that I think you gave it to me last, but it's actually the one that I'm going to use as the base for a lot of what we're talking about, because it goes to the base of the debate, is the Eric Van Rie Socialism in One Country, a Reassessment, you know, Studies in Eastern European Thought, article from 1998.
Right.
Holy crap, this article, like, is good.
It's so good.
It turned out to be the best one, I think.
That means that we're making this a real Nerd Hours podcast, then, if that's going to be the basis for our discussion.
Well, we can interject real, because I want to like talk about the implications for right now. But I've been walking through the, like, recently on Pop the Left, I did this whole long thing on and the revolutions of 1848 and then its implications for the Communist League and the Manifesto. And I started finding problems in, like, definitions that, you know, the whole Althusser / Marxist humanist debates completely paper over, because you have that hard epistemic shift theory, and then you have the you know, basically Marx was born whole and everything
right
just emerged, and it was just all like progressively being unrevealed to the, and what I started noticing was back and forth rollbacks in the manifesto, probably weren't, the origins weren't Marx and Engels themselves, but the dialogues with the Communist League, but still, like, and a lot of the problems had to do with nationalization. And that specifically came out of the 1848 context, and where nationalization they saw as, you know, liberal, because it was uniting actually a bunch of like micro principalities. But it's interesting to compare that writing from 1848 with Marx and Engels' writings in the 1870s and 1880s, when Engels is criticizing Kautsky and the Erfurt program for having too much faith in progressive nationalism.
Yeah.
And so, like, that tension has been emergent. I think it was emergent in Marx and Engels. And what I liked about the Van Rie article is that it points out that tension was always there, particularly when you look at the letter to Vera Zulik. And, you know, we'll get into that. But what does this mean for us when we're in a moment where, like, the right is obviously becoming more nationalistic? But whether we admit it or not, the left is too.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think that I have a clear conception yet of what I think it means for us, but I think it means something profound. And it's like one of those things that deserves a sort of an urgent investigation and theorization, because like on the one hand, you might have that, you know, you can throw a rock and find somebody on the left who can make what they'll call a socialist case for closed borders or something.
Right.
And the response to that is to be like, oh, that's right wing.
You're a Strasserite.
Right. But then the only thing that we have to respond with really is a version of, you know, liberal globalization in terms of like free movement as a right or whatever.
Right.
But there isn't like a internationalist politics to counterpose with a like left nationalism. So the left nationalism still tends to be, you know, if you think about it, what its aspirations are, a better stick to wield than the, you know, EU NAFTA, but somehow more fair line that is the only other thing we have on offer.
And well, a couple of things is like the current order that is international is the capitalist totality, which has always been international, which is why left nationalism has always been kind of a problem. Marx and Engels realized that early on. The issue was the countries that weren't part of the capitalist totality, such as, you know, early Russia, parts of the quote-unquote undeveloped world. But there, like, the answers there have always led to kind of equivocations. Like, you know, when one of the things I got from reading this is Lenin's equivocations on socialism in one country, which he never advocated, but like socialism as a kind of romp backwardsness while the capitalist developed to its demise or whatever was sort of the going stance. And it was justified off of like that alternate modernities model from literally that letter to Vera Zurlich, which is like, well, the Russian peasants communes might come up with a socialism that if it was plugged into the rest of the world could probably hold out and skip capitalism, but only if it was plugged into the rest of the world and only if eventually their capitalist world became socialist.
I mean, the complexity of the question is like, I think I appreciate it, right? Like the people who find themselves at the helm of the first, you know, national project, or it's already like a whatever transnational project in the former Russian Empire, that has the desire of transcending the questions of capitalism. And on the other hand, it does appear that like with every kind of like setback that they face, that they basically just, they do what, Susan Buck Morris called it, she refers to it as a retreat from the war against time in favor of a war for territory or whatever. So basically accepting the like capitalist framework of the world, which is like, this is the liberated zone, that's the enemy camp, so we'll defend what we have until we can take some more of that. And it basically ceases to be thought of as a project that is universal. And that's also kind of the Sartre essay that I thought was really interesting. It's the way that he goes back and forth from the universal to the particular.
And well, this is a problem. I mean, it's a side problem from this, but it's also a problem out of the post-90s non-Marxist left that is still with us. Because having to deal with decolonization, was why I brought up that Achebe essay, which, like I said, you guys haven't read. It wasn't on the reading list. It's not even explicitly socialist. But that tension is there between the universal in particular with with peoples, because a lot of the thing that attracts people to the nationalist question is the idea of, you know, oppressed and marginalized peoples, but and nationalization. But to really look at that, you have to look at something that wasn't covered in that Van Rie article, but you have to look at the difference between 30s and 40s Stalinism and then late Stalinism and Khrushchevism, if there is such a thing.
Sure, like the post-Stalin era USSR.
Yeah, which is Russification.
Right.
And why that happened. Because I actually think that wasn't just like that Stalin was a crypto-nationalist the whole time. Like, I don't really believe that. The idea of fairly parceling out nations really did balkanize Eastern Europe even further than anything the capitalist powers ever did. And then it led to new reactionary anti-Soviet nationalisms, which they had to suppress. So then you had the emergence of internationalism with chauvinist characteristics, which I was surprised that even like Fidel Castro and Che Guevara realized was a problem. And, mm-hmm. and they saw it explicitly with the Soviet Union, but they also began to see it with China. So it was like, oh, I did not know that they were like, because, you know, we always just people kind of cast them as like, you know, unreformed, you know, soft Latin tankies, basically.
And well, basically, like Russia worshippers.
Yeah. And it's a lot more complicated than that. They were more aware.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there was that. I don't know if you actually read this one.
I did.
I read it. The Celia Hart article.
Right.
Where she talks about the legacy of Che Guevara, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, you know, I sort of knew all of this about Che and Fidel anyway, as far as their, like, their attempts at formulating an internationalism that was sort of at odds with what the Soviets were trying to do at the time.
Right.
You know?
At odds with what the Soviets were trying to do, but not completely copacetic with the Maoist non-aligned policy.
Right, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Which now makes sense why there was all these like Trotskyist groups who were like, well, you know, all the Marxist Leninist Stalinist regimes are bad, except maybe Cuba. Because I was always like, why did the like USSWP and stuff like make a Cuba exception? And now I sort of get it. Like they did glom onto something real.
It's Cuba and Sankara. Those are their exceptions, you know,
for the same reasons.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I never understood when I was ISO trot. I didn't ever understand that because we were against nuance.
Well, it's the same way that the Fourth International for a period of time tried to make a similar exception with regards to Yugoslavia, and part of it I think had to do with self-management and the nominally pluralist nature of the like League of Communists as opposed to like a monolithic communist party. But I also think it had to do with, you know, some relatively vague hopes about the non-aligned movement and what that might mean for an alternate block of, you know, nations supporting each other. But it really all just speaks to the fundamental problem, which is the existence of the consequences of the socialism in one country debate.
Right.
You know, because you can maybe make a justification for, and I don't think a good one, but you can make a justification for this being the terrain of political debate inside Russia in the 1920s. But like the isolation doesn't actually last that long, but by the time it ends, it replicates itself. So now you have like a Poland and an Albania and a China and a Vietnam that all need their own steel industry, that all need their own, you know, like basically potentially autarkic economic relations.
Right.
So then you have all of the soft borders and the free movement and the free flight of capital back and forth as a transnational project actually happens in the West.
Right.
When it should have happened in the East, it should have been from East Berlin to Moscow to Pyongyang down to Hanoi as a single, you know.
But the reverse was actually true, and almost all, and it still is true in China, despite people not really knowing this. It wasn't just that you had the national borders become hard. You had polities, like smaller polity board. I mean, like, all those places have internal passport systems and stuff. Like, it was not, you don't have the liberation element of this really fell away. And part of that also, like, we can't give the, like, the internationalists, you know, the Trotsky answer to the nationalists a total pass because, you know, who did he side with? Zinoviev. Well, who's
right,
yeah. Like, who was one of the key instrumental players in playing the different parts of the socialist communist movement in 1921, 22, and 23 in Germany against each other, and also he meddled in the United States too and divided a lot of our parties. Zinoviev specifically was one of the key factors in Bolshevization, and he was like terrible to non-Russian parties. So, like, even Trotsky's allies were part of the problem, even if they agreed with him on the actual outcome of the solution.
I mean, that's why he loses, ultimately, I think.
Right. And the other problem that you have is the fear of the NEP, which, like, I'm not a right-wing socialist, but I actually don't know how Russia or any of the areas survive without something like an NEP, and that's what continuously happens.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, the way I grew to understand the NEP was that it was a step backwards for socialism, and it eventually led to what became the restoration of capitalism. That was the way I was always, like,
right. That's
trained.
A very Tony Cliff framing, though.
Exactly, totally. Exactly. And then reading about Bukharin now and reading about the NEP now, I've come around to the idea that there really was no other way, and that it sort of meshes with what Lenin had always said about the development of socialism in the Soviet Union, isolated from, you know, the socialist revolution popping off in the Western countries, was that there was going to be a necessary transitionary period where socialism was incomplete, which is actually goes back to Kautsky, as we read in that, Van Rie article.
Yeah, the Kautsky transition.
Yeah, this is where my, however post-Trotskyist my politics or whatever my present affectations might be. There's something fundamental about the debate, the Bukharin Trotsky debate, because that's what it really is. It's the Trotsky Stalin debate, right? Is the Bukharin Trotsky debate, which is
which Stalin jumps from side to side on, depending on who he was trying to outmaneuver.
Right.
Yeah.
But the way that they think of things is, you know, two different versions of solutions to the same recognized problem.
Right.
Bukharin being like, well, we got to build up and prepare for the next whatever, the next phase, the next wave of revolutions. And the Trotsky line, however wrong headed Trotsky may be and this or that thing, or however awful the Trotskyists are today, the fundamental insight is the necessity of more revolutions everywhere because it's the only way. And I think that just bears out time and again throughout the whole last century, staking it all on the next revolution as opposed to staking it all on our ability to build up a very effective wall and feed people or whatever.
Yeah, there's still, I mean, one of the things the Van Rie article convinced me of is, like, nobody actually has a true Marx, like, the true Marx line on this.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
like, there's even some things, like, that I'd never even thought about. Like, yeah, he says that Lenin's early stage model and Marx's early stage model are pretty much the same, except that Marx sees the state withering away, like, in the early stages of communism, socialism, and Lenin doesn't see it till the end, which is not a minor thing, actually. Like,
well,
that's kind of
right,
huge.
That's how you get
that really,
to a place
that really
where
helps make Leninism what Leninism is, like, to a very large extent, I think, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how you get to a place where you have, at the height of high Stalinism, you have this argument that's made with a straight face that we're on the precipice of the state withering, but in the lead up to that, we need a much, much stronger state.
Right.
Because you've got to wage the class struggle under socialism, and then presumably there's like a pivotal moment in which the withering happens all at once. Like, you have the building of the state apparatus to a crescendo, and then it comes withering at some kind of rapid pace or whatever. And at that point, I think, you know, whatever we could say about Stalin as like a true believer throughout his life, because I think that's true. Yeah, I think by that point, the dude's full of shit.
Well, yeah, I mean...
There's a crescendo of Stalin's true believerness that withers into him being totally full of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, but the funny thing about Stalin is, like, you know, I do sort of take the, what is it, Lars Lee in the Stalin Molotov letters book says that we wish Stalin was a little bit more cynical. I do often wish Stalin was a little bit more cynical. He was a true believer, but he was a true believer in the kind of way that like a lot of fundamentalist Christians are, that will invent shit whole cloth to not have to deal with a problem.
Right.
And then when you have that person as a head of state, the other thing you have to deal with is, frankly, Trotsky was a dick.
Yeah.
I think that's an undeniable fact of history. People didn't like him.
As right as he often was, and as especially in the debate on socialism in one country, as right as he was still a dick, and nobody wanted to work with him.
Yeah.
This is where it would have been better if Trotsky was a little bit more cynical, too.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Trotsky didn't have an Engels like Marx had to, like, because Engels was always, like, able to tampen down and be more presentable. Like, Trotsky didn't have that.
Right.
What did he have? He had Zinoviev.
Oh, Lord. To
make him look like that was to make him look like less of a dick in comparison.
But what I find fascinating about the Erich von Ries article, though, is that you really do see that both Stalinism and Trotskyism have justifications in kind of orthodox Leninism, and both of which have justifications in the Kautskyan interpretation of Marxism.
Yeah,
I think that.
We're all Kautskyans.
If I had not yet already arrived at this point, prior to this, I think that this essay in particular would have done a lot to shatter the real Marxist tradition SWP line that, like, you know, that there's the Marx Engels period, and then there's for some reason everyone's wrong for a long time, and then Lenin comes and makes it good again, and then Stalin makes it wrong, and then Trotsky makes it right. And that there's a continuity that basically leaps generations. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated and interesting than that. And also, I think there's an intellectual framework for abandoning a notion of Trotskyism that's very strongly set up in this article.
Right.
That could be the alternate title of our podcast is it's much more complicated and interesting than that, because I think you say that like all the damn time.
It's much more complicated and interesting than that, comrades. Like,
it's true. Yeah.
Which century is regrettable, Conrad? We're not quite sure yet.
So far, all of them.
All of them.
So, to bring it to this current regrettable century as opposed to the last one, why is this such an issue right now? Because I don't think that we can safely say that the living problems of the communist politics of the 1920s, even going through the national liberation period of the 50s and 60s, is actually active right now. Now, one, none of the movements that we belong to are mass. They're just not. That's, I think, an objective fact.
Yeah.
I mean, even the massest of mass movements in socialism has now petered out at about 60,000 people and has stalled and is probably even declining with only 10% active membership. Don't mean to talk crap about the organization that some of you are in, but it's an objective fact.
Wait, some of who? Not us.
Kevin and Jenny are here, but
yeah, so they're not present with us today. But
that's fair.
they're with us in spirit. I do not want to insult them.
right.
You know, I have my DSA friends too. We just don't talk about things very much. you know, you guys come out of, well, I guess I technically also come out of a Trotskyist organization. Mine's even weirder than you guys, so.
It's nice to feel like we're not the weirdest ones.
You are. No, Cliffites were never the weirdest ones. They were the most opportunist ones.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Laugh because I'm right.
It's funny because it's true.
Yeah.
Where does that leave
us? There's always posadas, so you're not even the weirdest.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I come from a post-Spart. You know, like there are the true Sparts who make us seem normal. But to really dig down into this, though, a little bit, what is it about right now, about the particular crisis of the last 20 years, that has made this more appealing when national liberation isn't even a coherent idea for a lot of the – because people talk about national liberation as if it is like a kind of like Marxist framework for identity politics – But yeah, that falls apart like pretty immediately. Like, what national basis do you have? The national basis in the United States, if like the black belt would be in immediate contestation with the indigenous rights. I mean, like, there's no way that if you looked at like, if that became an active real politics and not a symbolic stance, which is what it is right now, that wouldn't lead to massive problems immediately. But we don't have to deal with this because we are in a period very similar to the early periods of socialism, the Kautskyan period, actually, the true Kautskyan period of the SPD, the 1890 to 1920 SPD, where all these questions were purely fucking academic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my knee-jerk, let's say my gut-level first response to that question is it's just the burden of, you know, history weighing on us like a nightmare or whatever. We don't have, like, a continuity of a kind of, like, mass left which can...
But what was the last closest thing to a mass left we have was the anti-globalization movement?
Oh, I was going further back. I was going to say the early 70s.
Well, yeah. But again, that was influenced by national liberation, right?
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. I think that it's like we haven't had anything substantial happen to fundamentally change any of our presuppositions so that when we go back and, like, you know, young new leftists are, like, learning politics, you know,
but
academically.
We have had substantial things happen. All those societies that were formed under the National Liberation Projects have capitulated either to capitalism or to a kind of developmentalism that has not necessarily worked out in their favor in regards to China. I mean, so stuff has happened. We just ignore it because it's not liberatory.
Yeah, I guess more what I mean is that the politics of the last generation were basically developed in a completely academic sense, which
right.
just means picking up the previous generation's texts and, like, learning them rote. Which
right.
means learning the wrong lessons, but in a vacuum, like even in the absence of being able to be inspired by national liberation movements, so that this new generation, which is like, there has to be something that severs that connection. Like, if there is any continuity, it's only with, like, abstractly bad ideas.
Right. So yeah, it's like a reading group pathology, right? But
yeah.
But also, I think there's objective conditions on the grounds that we may not be hitting on, where we feel like there's so little movement that projecting it onto geopolitics is easier than making the necessary changes in your own society.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Well, that's sort of been the modus operandi of the left since the Reagan era.
Yeah,
in the United States,
for sure.
You know.
For sure, yeah. Both the Marxist and non-Marxist left largely. Like, let's cheerlead something, not really understand it, look like idiots later, give the right-wingers some talking points, cheerlead something again, not really understand it. Mm-hmm. Maybe actually end up being social imperialist in some weird way and fucking things up real bad, and then, like, you know, pretending it never happened. Yes, we've done that for 30 years, but what I am interested in, though, is, guys, you guys were Trotskyists, right? Like, you know, that was
the
thing. Trotskyism in the Anglo-speaking world until about 3 years ago was the dominant form of socialism since the end of the anti-revisionist period in the, like, 80s, where they all fell apart.
Yeah.
And even the tanky, and I'm putting it in quotation marks, I don't even like that term anymore because it's so overused by people don't understand it, contingent, they also come from Trotskyist origins and have forgotten their origins, like the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Workers' World Parties were both Marxite parties. I mean, like...
Yeah, that's the major tanky groups in the United States are just former Trots.
Yeah, they're all former all former Trots who literally picked up the 1930s Soviet education line, seriously.
Well, and the dominant group on the American left today has its origins in the rightward splits out of the Trotskyist movement.
Right. You know, with
like the American left is Trotskyist and post-Trotskyist. That's all it is.
Right. But Trotskyism is dead.
Utterly dead.
Like, it is of the left-wing tendencies, and even really, like, oppositional Maoism's dying. Like, I remember when the anti-revisionist Maoists, like, really hated China.
Yeah, I remember that. Remember the RCP was a thing?
Yeah.
Right.
And,
barely.
And, like, the anti-imperialist groups in the Third World just were really down on anything in China after 1970, I don't know, 5. And now we got this weird dingus-zeus thing all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's just a matter of the floodgates being open and very enthusiastic but politically unsophisticated people are just grasping at whatever they can, right? So you've got China, which is nominally socialist, and Xi is, you know, saying that China is making steps towards moving back away from Dengism and towards, you know, rebuilding.
Even though the Central Committee has more billionaires on it than...
Well, I mean, yeah, that's true, but that's what Xi says, right? So people will take that.
Yeah, they take it literally. They don't look at the Gini coefficient or any of that. Like,
and the other stripe of sort of leftist, you know, nationalism that exists is just
social democracy.
Exactly, social democracy. They look at labor in England. They look at you know, the Northern European countries and see something worth emulating there. And those are trying to build socialism in one country along an entirely different route, of course, than the, you know, the Stalinist route.
And we say this in light of Corbyn getting his ass world historically kicked. Like, that happened yesterday.
Yeah, that did.
Yeah, I mean, that's those are the stakes.
Rest in peace, Corbyn. Which I say with no satisfaction, because I actually allowed myself, you know, a very small amount of hope that they wouldn't lose this badly, but
I thought they would lose. I did not think they would lose this badly, but the tensions in Corbynism had always, because Corbynism wasn't just autarkic in a way, it was kind of talking out of both ends of its mouth towards nationalism, internationalism, both the Lexit and the remainder stuff. Neither argument makes a whole lot of sense. And
right. I was just hoping that an idea for a revived socialist labor would continue on. So, I mean, maybe it will. Who knows? But this doesn't look good.
No, it looks pretty. The Blairites are going to have a field day with this. But
they are. Look, I'm sympathetic with people who look at, like, the People's Republic of China and see Xi Jinping talking about a rupture with the last 30 years or like a new phase or whatever. I'm sympathetic with people who see that and think, okay, that's worth keeping an eye on, you know.
It is worth keeping an eye on, but it's not worth calling socialist.
Right. It's, I mean, you know, there's a difference between recognizing like that every society is in flux and that there are, you know, dynamics and by virtue of proclaiming de-Stalinization, Khrushchev kicked off, you know, people's desire for a genuine de-Stalinization, right? And then by clamping down on it, like, you know, that sometimes things can happen beyond the intended.
Right. Like Khrushchev was, you know, signing the orders that Stalin was handing out, you know? So it's like, the secret speech was one of the most cynical pieces of political theater in the history of politics.
It's one of the things I actually agree with the anti-revisionist on. Not that, like,
exactly. Yeah.
It's like Stalinism was a system. It wasn't just a bad dude.
Right. But people took it seriously, you know, and there were like material consequences for that, or like socialism with a human face in Czechoslovacia.
And then so, we had, you know, to crush it.
There are reasons to kind of like be hopeful about the way in which the, you know, Chinese working classes might look at with their
also consider Mao in China activating the youth to purchase political enemies from the party and accidentally creating the Shanghai Commune. You know,
yeah, that's Shanghai kind Commune, of yeah. all that yeah. stuff. But that is different than well, they said it, so it's true.
Right.
Right.
It's the same thing, the same way that like Hugo Chavez gets elected as a reformer who's pro-capitalism, then decides that the reforms he wants to enact can't be enacted under capitalism. So he says, oh, I'm for socialism now. We need a new party. And then 7 million people join it. Like, and that invariably means that there is now a contest for what exactly we mean by socialism in Venezuela.
Right.
Regardless of whether or not Hugo Chavez is a consistent or real socialist, like, that was always the wrong question.
Right.
It's what is it? What is it? How are people responding to such a thing?
Which is
the same goes for Fidel.
Yeah. The same goes for Fidel, because Fidel was not even he was just an he was perfectly willing to side with the United States to get rid of the Batista regime.
Yeah.
And he realized that the United States was going to screw him. So, like...
That's called the dialectic right there.
That's the problem with...
Ho Chi Minh, too, actually. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's the problem with politics as we were raised to understand it in the Trotskyist tradition, is it was always a question of whether or not this person was a real socialist, whether or not they had a real socialist program, whether or not they represented a genuine strain of socialism, and never about discussing the situation as it existed and examining the contradictions as they unfolded.
Well, yeah, right. Left communists even take this further than Trotskyists do. I don't mean to cut you off, but like they do.
Okay. No,
that's a tradition we have to contend with now too.
So like Sanders isn't going to call for a strike wave, you know? But the thing is that the Sanders moment could in fact touch off a strike wave.
Right.
To say it doesn't really matter what he thinks.
But the
it
Sanders
what
moment
do about it.
Has actually touched off Marxist-Leninism in America as a weird, not mass, but now viable position. And I say it's viable because Pearls of the Round Table is a top educational podcast on Stitcher.
Wow. I was unaware of that.
You know, they're the only socialist podcast I saw on it at all. Now, I know they actually don't have more subscribers or patrons but like, this is the moment we live in because these niche political positions can be projected. And I know I make this comparison in ways that it sounds flippant and almost like I'm a centrist, but it is sort of the left-wing equivalent of frog Nazism because you have to differentiate yourself. I mean, but I'm being serious. You have to differentiate yourself from like those milquetoast normie socialists, and the only way to do that right now is left communism, which seems very unappealing to a lot of people because you can't do anything. There's nothing to be done. The way the most left communists conceive of revolution.
Sure.
And the Trotskyists, who have been transparently bankrupt, usually put out of the way by sex scandals, rape scandals, and their own publishing companies. And...
Ouch.
Whoops.
Sorry, hitting home here. But, like... like, so what do you...
And those things tend to be the, like, last straw...
Yeah,
you know, the final.
Yeah, these are the death throes of rotten fucking organizations that have been on their last leg for like decades.
Right,
right. But I mean, the point is pretty well made, though, that like those tendencies have ushered themselves off the world stage.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What's
we didn't
left
need
is
help.
Weird internet tankyism.
Right, and then like you know, student level mass social democracy but one that. It's just mass enough to really dilute itself, I think. Like, to overstate its hand over and over and over again. Like, AOC is a rising power, has a certain amount of internet clout, but the idea that translates to the DSA, or that's a viable mass politics in America, it's not. I don't see the evidence for it, and... Honestly, the Corbyn problem is a problem that would affect Bernie Sanders, too, because the very things that Bernie would need to keep his coalition together would weaken his position. And there's no real way around that, particularly on a national parliamentary political scale. You know, and I'm not an insurrectionary. I just think we have to be honest about that.
Right. The whole point of a communist politics is about the recognition that, like, the resolution of this set of contradictions, it's only going to bequeath us new ones, and we have to be able to shift a lot. And so, like, you know, the seizing power and in whatever form, let's say let's use the language of the moment and say like a socialist majority elected to a parliament or a congress.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say the beginnings of a socialist project on a national scale immediately confronts us with this question of the existence of the nation itself. And we haven't, first of all, we're not even prepared for the fact that Sanders isn't likely to get the nomination, let alone win, let alone usher in a socialist government. But even if we were to get there, we're not at all prepared for the fact that the very problem facing us immediately after that is the existence of the socialist national project in the form of our own, you know, first victory.
And we don't have programs. Like, I was thinking about the Cuban program. So you have the Cuban nationalization of the banks. Well, our banks are already nationalized, sort of, kind of, anyway. But the other things, the pool of gold reserves, The establishment of licensing and the limitation of international trade to certain blocks. That's the first thing the Cubans did under Che explicitly. Like Che became the head of the central bank, which is pretty funny when I thought about it. But but that was actually all to limit capital flight, so that they then could hook up to another, to like a worldwide socialist movement. We don't have those, even those mechanisms, even if we nationalize industries immediately, et cetera. This is one of my problems with Corbynism, is a lot of the appeal of Corbynism was based on an economy in the UK that doesn't exist in the UK anymore because it's not efficient on the international scale.
Right.
Right. Corbynism was a politics for an era that was long gone.
Right.
Corbynism was just trying to revive 1950s labor.
Right. It was basically labor nostalgia. And Bernie Sanders is a little bit better in the sense that it's like 1960s Keynesianism with, you know, some class warfare involved.
And I don't think that those are bad as utopian myths to work towards, right? Because something more interesting and better could come out of that if there are people that.
But you'd have to have people within the Labor Party not only buying into that myth, but also questioning it, critiquing it from the Labor Party itself.
Right. It's similar to the Russian case in that the minute you get rid of everybody who disagrees with socialism in one country, then it becomes a dangerous myth, as opposed to a way of convincing ourselves we can get through over this next hump.
Right.
It's really similar in that, like, it's a good first start, but it does seem to be a tense that we end up staying in first gear in these things.
So the history of all forms of Leninism to me have been the history of taking necessity and turning it into principle.
Yeah.
And that's not even just like, that's also the Trotskyist, honestly, after Trotsky's death. That's the Bordigas, the other form of left Leninism, who go from being, you know, really dynamic and international and really, you know, questioning things to like the invariant program, which never changes and also actually is in direct contradiction to Marx on some key points that people don't question.
And does a kick-ass job of mishandling the fucking rise of fascism.
Yeah.
Well, oh, yeah. You
know. Well, the thing is, though, everybody mishandled. The Bolshevization of the party also mishandled the rise of fascism, so what do you do? But
yeah, that's true. But they had a front row view of it, and were stuck in this sort of calcified position that they were unwilling to make any modifications.
Oh,
to,
yeah. You know? But that's what happens. That's what's happened.
That was Bolshevization in general at the time.
But that's
right?
What's also what's happened to the most left oppositions, including, like, you know, Maoism in a way was a left was a form of Stalinism. There's a left opposition to Stalinism. Like, it also calcifies and reifies in ways that are. And to be fair, the kind of rightist, and rightist, I don't mean like right wing in the American sense, but the rightist forms of socialism, like national Stalinism and social democracy, have been more dynamic, but constantly turning their shit into some kind of principle that there really isn't one there. And if you actually principlify it, usually ends up to very bad results. So we're stuck with two tendencies that do the same thing, partly because we don't have a lib politics right now. I mean, most of us aren't involved in enough to, I mean, like, even like the DSA, what does it really do? It does small campaigns and then it gives money to certain candidates and that's really it. I don't know.
Yeah, I was involved in DSA for 2 years and I was involved in some. I attended some good study groups.
You probably attended some good study groups in the ISO too.
Better ones, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
Right. The point is that there actually aren't a lot of politics.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
There aren't political activity is not to be found.
Politics requires either power or a mass movement. We have neither.
No.
And barely aspirations for either as well.
Yeah. There's this weird sort of like national local divide that I see used in most leftists right now, and that's not just the DSA. It's a thing I see all over the place, where like the Nationals are seen as sort of like reformist or what milquetoast are weirdly in some of the harder parties, weirdly ideological. And locally it's like mostly activism, but without like, you know, you could be in any, the DSA or even the PSL and not really know their positions on something.
Yeah.
Like, and that's weird. So, and when you do know it, you tend to reify it and see it totally out of context because it's a bunch of great man quotes.
Right.
Yeah.
You can great man the quote out of Lenin to make him back almost anything. Like,
I mean, that's true. That's one of the things the Van Rie article illustrates really well. That like all the socialism in one country debates. I highlighted this. I really like this. He said, Lenin had been in the process of changing his mind. And Trotsky and Zinoviev have tried to cover up this fact. In an ironic way, they used the same debater's trick as Stalin and Bukharin. Which is to say, everyone presented an illusory Lenin who had always nurtured the same unalterable opinion of the problem at hand, and it just happened to be theirs as opposed to their opponents.
Right.
Where and Marx, we definitely still do that.
And Marx and Engels are slightly more consistent. I mean, slightly more consistent. But there's still tensions to seize in on. The tension between their call for worldwide development of communism all at once, basically. I mean, that's almost explicitly stated in the manifesto and maintained by Engels well into the 1870s. With that Vera Zurich letter, which posits that some non-capitalist societies might have other ways into modernity and thus into socialism. Like, yeah. That tension, which I think was not inconsistent on their part, created all kinds of space for Lenin to waffle, and then the waffling of Lenin created all kinds, which, to be fair to Lenin, they were waffling in like, actual historical conditions and trying to keep Russia afloat. Like, these weren't theoretical debate-winning waffles. These are like, I gotta survive the Civil War waffles.
Right, and our criticisms of Lenin's positions are with hindsight.
Right.
And, you know, I totally do not grudge him his waffling.
I tend to take a more sanguine view on Lenin than any form of Leninism.
Right, sure. Exactly. But one of the things that reading this article made me think, which, I mean, this was what happens anytime you get in sort of like theological debates with Marxists, is like, why the fuck do we need the red words of Lenin to back up a position anyway? Is it so that we can still call it Leninism? And then why do we need to do that? You know?
Yeah, that's
ideology is a hell of a drug, man.
But I mean, it was interesting because it seemed like even the quote unquote tanky leaders of the 60s were more willing to criticize Lenin than we are now.
Yeah.
And Leninism was a much more live and actually had life and death consequences than it does now. So,
well, we're so far removed from Lenin that, you know, we're like the early church fathers as opposed to the apostles, you know? So like the words of Lenin now are holy writ.
Right.
Right. And what we really should be thinking of something like the Russian Revolution and its immediate aftermath as being in the same category as the French Revolution and its immediate aftermath.
Or the American Revolution and its immediate aftermath.
Right. Like so far removed from our moment in history that we needn't feel any emotional connection to it other than to be inspired by the fact that people make revolutions.
I mean, in some
ways...
But,
like, we don't have to, like, defend a Cromwell. Like, we don't have to be in the tradition of Cromwell and defend things Cromwell did to learn from the English Civil War. And similarly with Robespierre and the French Revolution and Lenin Trotsky and so on. It's really bizarre that we have to have, like, positions which flow from a moment in history now a full 100 years behind us.
We don't have to be defenders of Cromwell to be defenders of chopping the heads off the royal family.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what's interesting to me about this is it proves how alive our politics is. I mean, very few revolutions, even the Chinese Revolution, does not really get approached in the same way. And I think part of that's a remnant of the Cold War, frankly. We're all still kind of like fighting in the shadows, even though clearly we lost. And like part of that is looking for a map when there isn't one, but there really isn't one because our analog would not have been Russia anyway. It would have been Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and like, yeah, that's just a bizarre accident of history that we are still pointing to what should have been like Russia to the European Revolution should have been similar to like the Netherlands to the French Revolution, like an analog, right?
Right.
I think we have more proletarians in South Texas than they had in the entirety of Russia.
No, for real. I mean, the other thing, like, you have to...
Like, not a joke.
Like, if you have to look at, like, developmental standards, the French Revolution of 150 years before the Russian Revolution was coming out of a society that, by our standards, is more modern.
Yeah.
Like, parts of... I mean, yes, there was shit, industrialization of Moscow, but by and large, like, Russian peasant life was like the equivalent to the 12th century, not even the 16th. It was
medieval, absolutely medieval.
Like, right, and so
I
like
mean, developmentally, I would say like it's more like the Russian peasantry had only been not serfs for 40 years,
not even
something like that,
barely a generation. Yeah.
Right. So those circumstances, like materially, they do help explain why there is a nationalist, a socialism that exists in Russian political thought
to this day, too.
Right, to this day, but you know, and it pre-Bolshevism, and it runs through Bolshevism, and it never really goes away. And part of it's because of the isolation from it. Not in reality, but in people's immediate vision from the capitalist world, so that you could, you know, like, of course, it's French finance capital that builds the Trans-Siberian Railway, but yet the reality of global capitalism isn't immediately apparent to people, so that you can see why people would develop a kind of an autarkic notion of like, if we can just be left in peace, we can develop, we can exploit our natural resources, we can establish bonds between our peoples, you know, whatever, Uzbeks and Kazakhs and Russians,
right,
and so on. It just turns out to have not actually been the case, because all the capital needed to develop, they had to get from
relations with capitalists. There's also other questions in the sense that, like, all these revolutions and the quote unquote backwards countries were also highly dependent on peasants, and peasant involvement. Otherwise, they would have never had enough people to do anything. And also, that was how they had not – there was no what we would call agrarian proletariat, which is a different problem and cause – it has actually been a crucial problem in Germany and England, and rightly kind of now in the United States, because the agrarian proletariat usually tends to have quasi-peasant tendencies, but not truly peasants. Right. So like they
right.
Can't...
It is a different social reality for them.
Right. So like a lot of the questions that lead to the development of socialism in one country and in these national liberations, even in the third world, they're not relevant at all.
No.
The classes that make them up don't even exist under this form of capitalism.
Imagine being a national a socialist. Nationalist in the United States,
you occasionally see debates on the peasant question, and you're like, there are no peasants in America.
There aren't. No. I mean,
there isn't even a fucking middle class in America anymore.
I think that, like, you know, we'll have to check the numbers on this, but like the CIA World Factbook has like a breakdown of like the American workforce and the percentage of it that is involved in various sectors. And for fishing, forestry, and farming, it's like 1% or less.
Berdiga
says that includes people who own their own farms and also agricultural laborers employed as wage earners, which is easily the 90% of the people involved in those fields.
Right.
There's not even a traditional farming class that exists in this country anymore.
No.
I mean, there are more homeless people in Cuba than there are small proprietors in the United States. That's probably not true.
Wait, no, I don't think there are any homeless people
in
Cuba.
That's what I mean. Yeah. That's the wrong answer.
There are more homeless people in Chile than there are small proprietors in the United States.
It involved in the exploitation of the land, right? In the agrarian sector.
Yeah.
I got you. The point of all that was, I think, that like, you know, you can see why there might be a Russian debate about socialism in one country.
And
the tragic consequences of that debate are that, you know, the Cold War, the 20th century happens the way that it happens. And then we still think that our project as a left today is to like resurrect old forms,
also
which were hybrid compromised forms based on winning in the place where we shouldn't have been able to win.
Right. The other funny thing about all that, though, is also the socialism of one countries, they were national projects to they created national projects to begin with, because they also came out. They didn't go through a nation state phase. The Russian Empire was actually a weird rump empire based on like the Habsburg model, and like the Chinese Empire was even weirder, as far like it didn't come out of a model that was properly speaking modern.
Right.
And I'm not saying that because they were backwards. I mean, China was much less backwards than Russia, but like what do you do with that? Because also you had to invent a nation there, almost. Like,
well, I mean, it's the same thing with Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
It's just like you're creating nations out of something. I mean, Yugoslavia was just a piece of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that fell off,
you know? Right.
after World War One, they were creating a nation based on like romantic Pan-Slavic ideas from the 19th century that never played out.
I didn't even realize that like the Turkmen language, for example, was invented by the Soviets so that they had their own coherent singular language.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece of trivia that I learned, right?
I was like, wait, what? They were actually inventing languages for nations that didn't have one? Like, weird. That is odd. You know,
it's actually kind of cool. Like, and it really sort of like helps underscore the earnestness with which the Soviets embraced the idea of giving national identities their own autonomy. Or tried to.
Right,
anyway.
They tried to until they didn't. Yeah. Like, that's the thing.
They tried, yeah, exactly.
When they didn't, they really didn't. It was this weird, like, you know, one day, like, one of the things that even my Soviet defensist friends have a hard time justifying, for example, is what happened to the indigenous of Siberia under Russia. Like, ugh.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Our Soviet dominance. And, you know, I just... I think maybe we're at a time where the imagined community of a nation state seems progressive in the way that maybe it did during those rump empires of the 1820s and 30s, but we live in such a different world that that's an even bigger myth to me. Like,
right. If anything, if you think about, we're like well into the era of the dominance of the multinational. To where even like the old formulations about imperialism in the like fusion of monopoly capital with the state power, it really seemed kind of like they're outdated.
Yeah.
They don't really accurately describe the world that we live in
anymore.
I hate
to say it, but Kowski's actually right. Ultra imperialism seems more true now than it actually did when he came up with the idea that capitalists would attack each other because of the mutual danger to the means of production. And I'm like, you know, that seems real now. Like,
yeah, I mean, it just,
well, you know, what's interesting to me is like a right wing friend of mine said that he doesn't like to call America's foreign adventures imperialist because it's not accurate. He says that the United States is a mercenary force that's for hire to, you know, capital to do its bidding. And I was just like, fuck.
Yeah, yeah,
right. And
we are the maintainers.
This is only
of
a really
capital.
Big deal to us if we need whatever Lenin said one time to still be true. But if we don't, we could actually be assessing the world in a different way, and we can escape the problematic of socialism in one country by recognizing that capital is fully global, and so the struggle against capital is only global.
And it isn't just capital flight. I mean, the one thing I really liked about the Cuba example. Is that capital flight isn't, you know, everybody talks about capital flight and international pressures. That's not actually even the primary problem. You think back to like Animal Farm. I know I'm going to use a crazy, like, you know, almost right wing Trotsky example in Orwell here, but Orwell actually talks about the stuff that the animals just cannot produce on their farm. They can't do it. There's no way for them to do it. And it's not just capital flight problems. It's also supply chain problems. It's also international production problems. It's getting lithium. I mean, like, this is not something that's dealt with in these all-target situations. And, you know, one of the things to me is, like, the left doubling down on this after Chiriza happened seemed weird.
Yeah.
Like, that to the failure of Chiriza and Podemos and the move towards more right-wing things in Europe has kind of put a loss on me. And also the failure, with maybe the exception, no, I mean, at this point, Maduro's isolated, Cuba is quasi-liberalizing, and the pink wave everywhere else is dead. So what do we, like, we're at a moment where those attempts actually have been tried recently and they failed.
Well, I think one of the conclusions that people draw from the Greek example is that the problem is that there was no Grexit, right? Which is why you can see a sort of emergent or a strengthened left nationalism, because a Grexit supposedly would have enabled Greece to just default on all their debts and then get bailed out by China or whatever.
That's because everybody believes, though, that currency is more important than production because they're an idiot.
That's because the value form is only being really discussed and theorized by, like, a couple hundred people.
Right.
And again, that's what I'm not good with numbers. I'm sure it's much more than that. But it's not preeminent, right? Like,
I thought that if you talked about value form, that made you a theory bro that just needed to get out there and do something.
It does, right? Obviously.
Well,
and also a Strasserite.
You know.
Oh yeah, that's true.
As a person who does local activism and actually is still a value form bro, actually a value theory bro. I'm not actually a value formist, but, like,
yeah.
I don't know how we could organize an economy without dealing with the nature of money. Now, I also don't know that, like, any answer to the theory of values right now is actually coherent. So, like, I'll give people their frustrations with it, but
yeah, be frustrated all you want, but fucking talk,
like,
about it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we got to be really comfortable with not having answers to any questions, at least for a little while, because we've got to move beyond the comfortable answers because all of the ones we have are wrong.
Yeah, if you think you have answers to questions right now, you're full of shit.
Yeah, fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you.
But don't you feel like more people right now feel like, I felt like in the Obama years it was safer to say we don't have answers. And in this weird way, this is what I was kind of getting at. I've been really fascinated with how weirdly Bonapartist the entire world's thinking is right now, because, like, we let the tone of how we respond to things be set by the executives in a few countries.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what do we think Bernie's going to do without, like, ousting half the Democratic Party, for example? Nothing. He could actually accomplish more in the Senate, except for in foreign policy, where he doesn't have as coherent of a stance.
Yeah, he doesn't have a very good track record in the Senate on foreign policy.
No, he doesn't. He often talks a good game, but capitulates in votes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, there isn't an answer for that. I think some people think that, like, a Sanders presidency would inaugurate an organizing drive in every sector of the workplace, of the economy, like that every workplace would, by virtue of the fact that you could say your president wants you to join a union, that more people would be trying to organize unions. But, like, it's there are a lot of mental gymnastics you have to go through to get from complete demobilization of the class
to complete mobilization.
Yeah,
but,
and I know that we've had a teacher strike wave, but, like, it's only a strike wave in comparison to the 80s, not compared to, like, the whole century.
And also, teachers can't be scabbed on. I say this as a member of a teachers union. We don't operate like the rest of the labor force. We're credentialed and protected.
Well, and teachers don't produce value.
Don't tell anyone.
Teachers can't bring the society to a halt. They can be inspiring, like student walkouts can be inspiring.
Well,
a
I mean,
whole bunch of...
we could actually break the production circuit if everybody quit at all levels. But that's what it would take. You'd have, like, not just the high school teachers. Like, we'd have to have colleges shut down and people refuse to do trainings. That's like the general strike of education, which at that point you might as well have a general strike. It's just as eschatological, honestly.
Right.
Hey, man, it's a good myth.
You're all really Sorellians, aren't you? No. <That's>...
Well, yeah, so, but
that is a Sorellian concept that I think I'm not willing to throw out with the bathwater.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, like, the linen myth is like a Sorellian myth at this point that's like hanging around our necks like a fucking albatross. And I don't even dislike linen. Like, I'm just tired of these mythics, like coherent Leninism that we all get tied in knots around trying to come up with the perfect program that we can pull out of our butt full form as a transition into socialism and then immediately transition into communism. Like,
right. I mean, like, one of the under-theorized things is the transition debate. And, like, the real transition debate is not the, like, the Brenner-Wood debates, but, like, the transition from capitalism to a society without the coercive rule of capital and the dominance of the commodity form, right?
Right.
And that's, like, maybe, like, the last bit I can pull out of the Van Rie article is the constant redefinition of socialism as, like, a stage, like, a social existence in between capitalist society and the communist future, which is a really bizarre theoretical construct.
Right.
But it's this comfortable thing that we do to make us feel like, well, it's always further away than we are, right? The need to like make the despotic inroads into capital and the withering of the state and all the rest of it.
Well, the other funny thing about that is that, like, it takes the kind of vague things in the Critique of the Goethe program where Marxists happen to use communism for the higher stage. But if you look at Marx's writings, he's not consistent on what it like on communism or socialism being a stage like that. He has stages. He uses names all over the place for them, actually. So depending on the political formulations that he was dealing with. So, for example, communism originally was formulated by a German. That's why he used it, as opposed to like socialism, which was by a bunch of petty bourgeois French revolutionaries. And I mean, I'm not saying like literally petty bourgeois, because that was the form of they were artisans,
right? Right.
And
gotcha.
Like, I'm not using it in
not
the, like,
a pejorative.
Vague, your ideology is petit bourgeois the way that a lot of trots do. I mean, like, they were literally artisans, so that was the distinction. But he went back and forth between which words he used. The idea that those were stages is because he mentions stages being necessary in the Critique of the Goethe program. And then that gets reified and reified and reified. Like, you see Guevara, like, die-harding. Like, there's this recursive stages, and he's getting it from the Lenin-Stalin-Trotsky debates and all. But this is a systemic typology that was based off of like some very vague things that Marx said. I'm a Critique of the Goethe program is the Marxist text I've read the most, and it's vague on some key questions.
Well, I think that's why Yugoslavia is relevant and why it's worth dissecting and discussing.
Not just your fetish for Yugoslavia.
Right, not just my fetish for all Slavic forms of socialism. No. The reason I think it's interesting and worth studying is because of its like sort of liminal nature as a transitionary state that just, you know, shits the bed and goes kaput, whatever,
right.
You know. But the interesting contradictions that unfold within the self-management model and the giving autonomy to regions model and just the breakup of the monolithic communist party into like a communist league and allowing like partisan formations to have their own sort of democratic forms that aren't sat upon by the state. There's so much happening in there that is worth
like
looking at.
Like partial de-Bolshevization, which is actually delivering on a promise Lenin actually said he was going to do.
It all ultimately failed, but I don't think it's because they tried something new. I think it ultimately failed because it was, you know...
Right, it failed because of the national confines. It failed because
exactly.
It wasn't being extended into Bulgaria and Albania and all up and down the Warsaw Pact all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
Right, and also couldn't properly trade with the either two communist pacts most of the time. It was both shut out of the China Non-Aligned Pact a lot of the time and also shut out with Soviet trading. It really was kind of going it alone.
Right, and that is a consequence of the particularities of Russian socialism as this desired stable socialist society that would like develop peacefully into higher and higher versions of itself and like pull other parts of the world along with it, rather than, you know, the permanent revolution, however you want to conceive of it, but the way that Marx talks about the revolution needing to make it permanent, which is to say it can't stop at national borders because it ends. It has to be permanent until there's nothing left to revolt against. And then then the state withers away, right? Mm-hmm. That's why it's an internationalist project. It's not like an aspiration that is just feels nicer, but it's because we have seen the limitations imposed in it internally by stopping the revolution at like a national border, which is a bourgeois construct in the first place.
Right.